you say what the hell I feel.
Artlist IO.
Every single day I feel the pressure. Double up the work, let's make it extra. Working so my mother get arrested. Yeah. Working like I never know I'm best. Yeah. Every single day I feel the pressure. Diamonds
welcome
in my
back,
eyes,
welcome
no
back
stress.
To That One Studio. It's your boy C-Rock on the What Are You Made Of show. Another great guest in the building. No, in her building. I always say that all the time because one of my lines, Tawny, is C-Rock in the building. Let's go. But yeah, she's in her own building and I'm in my building. And we're going to find out what Tawny's made of. Tawny Nguyen is the host of the Fit and Frugal podcast. It's a movement for the audacious few obsessed with creating a genuinely fulfilling life. They challenge the status quo with raw, unfiltered truths and flip the script on typical self-help cliches, proving that you can create your own path without following the crowd. She's also a former high-functioning alcoholic bartender turned investor and podcast host, as I mentioned. Tawny, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. How do you know I'm not in your building, man? Just like sneaking around in the back.
Oh, but when I come to Vegas, we're going to be in the same building. We're going to figure something out. You're going to show me around. I always do that, right? Like I'll go to Vegas and I've been there before.
Yeah.
But I really think it's cool because everybody's got a different perspective of Vegas, mm-hmm. right? So like I don't drink much anymore.
Yeah.
So I don't want to go drinking and staying out all night. I don't mind staying up, but I don't drink and party. So sometimes I'll go with some entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
And we go to Vegas and approach it through the entrepreneurial lens. And then I'll go podcasting and I'll just through the podcasting lens. And then, oh, by the way, for the audience, I don't think I told the audience this before. So I was in Vegas the last time and I was speaking with Todd Ault at Risk On, and they took us to the Motor Speedway, right?
Nice.
And we got in those Indy cars or the Formula One cars, yep. and we rode around that racetrack, 180, 190 miles an hour.
Wow.
So that's a different perspective. So I switch it up every time I go, but yeah, we're going to have to see your perspective of Vegas sometime.
Todd is a cool dude. Him and Bill, I just saw last week. Are you coming to the Risk On conference in November?
So I've spoken at the last two.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, I'll probably be there.
So
yeah.
I'm assuming I'll see you there.
I'm not sure. I was on a. Yeah. So I told you about him when we talked and then you ran into him.
Yeah, I met him a few months ago at a different like mastermind, you know, one of those events here. And then last week I was at Bill Walsh's event, just hanging out. And then he just happened to pop by and we're like, hey, what the hell? Like, what are you doing here? He's like, I don't know. What are you doing here? I was like, I live here, man. Because we're both
from
Orange
County. Bill Walsh is awesome too. He's a different type of character.
Yeah.
And his style on stage is different from a lot of people's.
Oh, yeah.
And Todd's just an awesome dude. Like, I was his first podcast he ever went on.
Really?
Yeah. So during COVID and he was in a bad spot.
Yeah.
Restaurants shutting down, all kinds of stuff. And we got deep with him. And so now he's a good friend and he's a client of ours too at the agency at That One. And mm-hmm. I just love him and his team. They're awesome people. So anyway, let's talk about you, Tawny. I don't want to talk about Todd anymore. Let's talk about you. So I start this show with the same question every time. And it's written on the wall behind me because I don't want to forget, I guess. So you might have to turn your head sideways. But the question is, what are you made of?
Man, you know, I thought about this for a little bit there because there's so much that we are made of. Like if you want to go on the spiritual side, like the easiest way to put it is like we are all made of stardust. But that's some, you know, spiritual bypass. But I think the real answer I really thought hard about was like, what am I made of and who am I showing up as? So I would say it's a combination of wit, grit, kind candor, and a little bit neuro spicy. I think that's truly who I am. A little neurotic here and there.
I love it. Mm-hmm. I love it. Great answer. What was the last part? I missed the last part.
A little neuro spicy. So that just means I'm slightly neurotic. Okay. I'm okay
all
with
right.
that.
Well, we'll talk about that too.
Yeah.
So where did it all start for you? Like, where'd you come from?
So I moved here from Vietnam from a single mom divorce since I was, you know, four. My mom, not me. So we came here with a green card marriage. So this is the part of my story that I was ashamed of for so many years, just because that gave me a different interpretation of love and marriage, just because I witnessed my mom go through, you know, relationship failure as a woman. And there's a lot of shame and guilt I carried with me as a child. So when we came here at 10 years old, I was forced into like child labor, and the family that we paid money to bring us here didn't treat us well. So, you know, practically we just escaped in the middle of the night through the basement in Virginia, really white countryside, you know, probably 20, 30 away from Washington, D.C. So part of that kind of made my brain really fuzzy because I seek therapy since I was a child. Cause I'm like, hey, I have all these flashbacks of like trauma that I cannot undo. So I was diagnosed with, you know, CPTSD at a really young age, at 11 years old, when we came here to California. And we were homeless, we were, you know, struggling, we left everything behind. And my mom and I, we left, you know, all the money we brought, all the clothes we had, the gold, whatever that my grandma did to support us to come here to seek the American dream. We left all of that shit. So when we came here, we got nothing. We were living out of shopping carts, sleeping on people's floors. It was fucking wild, man. So that part of my identity, I held on for so long in shame, and I never got around to sharing it and made peace with it until I'm now going to turn 35 this year. And I'm like, you know, it's time I make peace with that part of myself. And hopefully it connects to other people that's gone through some rough childhood stuff too.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, 30, mid 30s. I mean, like, Vietnamese people age well. I would never guess. I thought you were, I honestly thought, not from your maturity level, but for those watching, some people are listening, but for those listening, she looks like she's like 27. So just so everybody knows, but her maturity level, I did not question on that. But Tawny, in Vietnam, is it same as the United States where like 50% of marriages end in divorce?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
And then so your mom was seeking a better life, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why she came here, I assume, right?
Yeah. So our generational pattern is like, I'm an only child and she's also an only child, except her childhood was, I guess, spoon fed with more wealth because my family was a lot wealthier in Vietnam outside of the whole, you know, socialist communist thing that came and took all of my family's wealth growing up too. So I witnessed a lot of that loss as a child. I can't remember most of it. It's just really hard because now I'm kind of reliving the narratives of what stories my mom has told me of family traumas that we've been through. So I know she tried to escape Vietnam a couple times, like by boat, you know, the typical like immigration, you know, buying your way out of Vietnam didn't work at the time. So she did like have a really crazy freaking story about how she tried to escape in the middle of the night. Didn't tell my grandpa because he was a monk. So there's no fucking way in hell he would have let her fled the fucking country on a boat. You know what I mean? So she tried to flee the country and then the boat crashed and then like everyone on the boat died. That's what she told me. And she was really traumatized from that. She was washed ashore, thrown in Vietnamese communist jail. And then sometime later, like my grandparents had to go get her and she was in like the biggest trouble of her life. And she's like, what the fuck just happened? You know? And that was kind of like re-traumatizing. So every time I try to do something rebellious, she's like, oh my God, like, what are you doing? Cause I'm an only child. And then I'm just really fucking reckless when I was growing up. Part of the whole, you know, only child and reparenting through like, while her and my dad, my stepdad now were dating. So of course I'm gonna be like, I thought I was your, you know, a whole different fucking ballpark right there.
Right, man. And so when you came to the United States, right? How old were you?
I was 10.
Okay, so you're 10. What are some of the, like, do you have some stories for us that you, I know, I mean, obviously you gave us some overview, but like, what are some specific stories that you dealt with 10 to in your 20s, like that you got into because of the way you were thinking at that time? Like, do you have some stories of that, like from that?
Yeah, you know, so growing up in poverty and scarcity, I couldn't wrap my head around the fact that we were poor, but we were like dirt poor. Like my mom was struggling. We were working in the back of like restaurants, right? Illegal child labor. Of course, I think this might be like a normalized Asian thing to where if you're an Asian growing up in a household, like you have to contribute something. And that kind of leads to suppressing your own feelings and emotional needs. And practically it normalizes like emotional neglect as a child. But for me, I think the way I learned how to make money was I started going to like garage sales because all the kids at school, I got stuck into bullying really young because when I came here from Virginia, I couldn't speak English, you know, so when you go to California and everyone else is Asian, but like they speak English, I had to take ESL classes. So being really smart in Vietnam, I was in private boarding school and all of that, like child prodigy coming here. I couldn't even test into like fourth grade reading because I couldn't understand the math and the language that was spoken here. So I was immediately like kind of bullied and that destroyed my self-worth growing up. So for me, I just attached my identity to making money and how am I going to help my mom survive pretty much, right? So I started going to garage sales and like just buying stuff with whatever money I have. I used to steal growing up too. So I would like go steal stuff and like sell it for money. And that led me to hang out with like older kids. And then the whole drug thing got involved, you know, because you don't know when you grow up with street kids that they know how to make money. And they're actually really good characters. It's just society kind of looks at them badly because of the actions that they choose to do. But I think for me growing up, I was more involved in that that part of town and just hiding who I was and just really living with the fact that like I was just bullied at school, like in since middle school and high school and all of my mentors and dealing with my own mental health issues and just dealing with a lot of stuff that I started drinking around that age too, because I didn't know any better. And that was my only escape. And that was the only way I could numb my pain. And stealing and, you know, selling stuff and doing illegal activities was the only way I could afford to go to therapy without telling my mom that I'm like struggling with like really vivid, like flashbacks and I couldn't sleep. I had night terrors and just all of these parts of my childhood that kept coming up. And I needed to talk to somebody and I couldn't talk to my mom, right? Because she had to go through her own stuff. And,
yeah,
you know, we're all just so preoccupied with just trying to survive this new world, this new Californian lifestyle that is really freaking expensive. Even in the 2000s, it's still expensive, you know. But she wanted to be around more similar people, like similar language speaking people, because she didn't want me to grow up like white as hell, you know.
Yeah. And so how did you end up in California from Virginia? Like what was the process there?
The process there, from what I can remember her explaining to me, is when we escaped in the middle of the night, we were sitting like on the side of the road. It was snowing. This was mid like peak winter, like January. And I think she was afraid like I was dying, because we didn't leave with much clothes. We had like whatever clothes we wore. We didn't take anything with us. And I think like an older couple found us on the side of the road, like as I was turning purple, and like she thought she was losing me. So we were just like, you know, just dying on the side of the road. And I think they picked us up and housed us and, you know, and just kind of like gave us the money. And she had to call my grandma in Vietnam. And I don't know how she went through that process. That's not something I have the memory of, but she tells me the story all the time. Like there was this one time, like I thought I was going to lose you because I was 10 years old, you know, dying in the middle of the of the snowing road. And I think that part of my memory is still not live yet. So maybe a little bit more therapy. I don't know, but
yeah, gotcha.
Yeah.
And then you go to California and you become a teenager and you're partying. By the way, I say this a lot on the show. Drinking and partying is fun at first. Mm-hmm. It's exciting. There's not just the high off of drugs or alcohol, but like the partying and being the community. There's community there, believe it or not, yeah. Right? There's community with it. Connection, acceptance. So there's stuff that a lot of us that go through those things at a young age, like we're craving.
Yeah.
And it's easier to get into that community and connection and all that in that scene. And then eventually it starts to get dark, right? Can you take us through that journey? By the way, night terrors. Jeez, Sooks. I've had nights when I was a kid. I don't do it anymore because I've worked on myself, but I remember as a kid, I would wake up screaming bloody murder. So I've been there. I understand that. And it's not fun. I remember some of the dreams I've had. I can't even explain them, but I just remember how scared I was from them. And so I think all of us, like there's probably stuff I don't even remember. Right. But as you got older, teenage, 20, you know, into the 20s, like what kind of experiences did you have then? What was the journey like then to the point where you had to, you know, you were able to start working on yourself?
You know, my whole entire journey as a young adult was just suppressed by drugs and alcohol, because that was the only way I knew how to fit in. Because I think societal values, people that want to do things to be around other people, and drugs and alcohol, like you said, is exactly that. That was the friendship I thought I had, because it's really popular if you're a drug dealer and everyone knows you have drugs and they want to come to you and they know you got money and then you're always paying for stuff, right? So that's the whole identity. When I started getting into raving and EDM music and all of that, it was just a bunch of us just trying to escape our thoughts. I think mental health has a big tie to who I was as I was growing up. It's because I didn't have anyone to talk to outside of a paid therapist. And a lot of that in my 20s, I think I started raving when I was like 15. It's just a nice way to disconnect from reality and not talk about the drugs or the LSD or the mushrooms or anything. This was before it was mainstream during my age. It didn't get mainstream until all of us went to college. But when I went to college, I dropped out at 18 because, you know what, I decided, I'm like, I don't think this nursing pre-med route thing is for me. It just didn't tie to who I am as a person. And I was going through so much shit at the time that I think until I was 18, three of my friends, I committed suicide, and those were the only friends I thought I had, and they were going through their own stuff too. And I never talked about it just because I felt like, wow, like you kind of take that burden on yourself as well. So it's just switching groups of friends and just denying that part of you, that shadow that I carried for so long. And it wasn't until I was like 27 that I decided to try to work on myself. But that was a whole spiritual bypass phase that I went through with the crystals and the Reiki and all of the fluffy, nice things that makes you feel good for a while. But really, like when I decided to work on myself was when I was 30. I was in a really long-term relationship that I was miserable in because that's what society tells you is successful, especially for an Asian woman at 30 who's not married, who didn't have a college degree. When I was 25, I felt like a failure because people were getting married and having kids and having college degrees and having the house and having the da 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 da, right? The whole checklist of what society deems as successful as a woman, especially as being an Asian woman. So I had a lot riding on my plate at the time, and I didn't have the right supportive partner. I didn't know how to get in relationships, and I was codependent. Like I was a walking red flag outside of my alcoholism. So all I knew was to attach my self-worth and my identity to how much I can drink and how much I can produce in terms of monetary contribution. But I never had the time to be willing to look at myself. And that's the internal work that it's easier to avoid than it is to just really be present with yourself, because there's all the noise that the minute you're by yourself, you have to listen to your own thoughts and you really have to face yourself. And it's probably the ugliest thing I've ever had to face, you know. Oh man, like that was crazy that, you know, when I was 31, I started sharing this recently, but there was times in when I was 31 that I planned on like ending my own life so many times, and it's been an ongoing pattern since I was a child. Because that's all I knew. It's like, how do I get away from this pain? And how I can't sit with it. But what is the easiest way? Like I can just like alleviate myself. But then the guilt starts coming because I'm an only child. Like, what's my mom going to do? Because I've seen other people's parents that has gone through their kid ending their life. And I'm like, fuck, I can't do that to my mom. You know what I mean? So the guilt and all of that shit start kicking in. And then, you know, you sit with yourself. You're like, wow, I'm fucking worthless. My partner doesn't even know how I'm feeling. Well, I can't call him partner. It was an ex-boyfriend. I never had a partner until this point. It was until I decided to work on myself, my patterns, and then asking for what I truly want and how I want to show up in the relationship that I really started aligning to a partner that can actually meet my needs, you know?
Right, right. And you can meet their needs effectively, right?
Not just being an autopilot, and so, like coexisting, you know, warm body bed syndrome and not knowing who the hell they are. They don't know who you are either.
Nah, I've been there. I can relate to all this, man. I mean, but let's take a step back. Like when I started partying, I didn't drink until I got out of high school. And then I realized like the drug thing, like you're talking about, if you have access to that, then I was in that teenage boy years where like, man, hot girls, you know, and then hot girls came when you had a party.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, now they're not, they still needed to work on themselves. And as human beings, they weren't really great people, but they looked good on the outside. And I was like, this is awesome. I mean, I'm being honest with everybody here. Okay. I was like, this is awesome. The hot girl. And you know, like, you know, I'd rather have girls come to me because I'm a good looking dude and a good dude, right? Not because I have the party scene, but that's what it was like. And I was just like, I got sucked up into it too. So, and then that led to relationships that didn't work out, codependency. Like you said, like I felt so abandoned when I was a kid. And then when the relationships would end or what have you, I felt like abandoned and, you know, all that stuff. Yeah. So I can relate to this so much. It's crazy. And I know a lot of the listeners can relate to this too. I want to point out something though, like there's a lot, suicide is a big deal, right? There's a lot of that going on. And I just want to remind everybody, like nothing's permanent except for suicide. And so everything else can get better. There's light at the end of the tunnel, even if you don't see it when you're in the midst of an adversity or a feeling. And it's so important to just ask for help and keep going, you know, and I can't stress that enough to people. So what was the first thing that really you started to notice that worked for you, that started to make you feel better in a good way? And then you could like add on to it and build upon.
I think the first step is coming to terms with how bad your life is and how unhappy you are. And then the grace and the compassion part is the two hardest emotions I had to work through or to gain from myself, because I was filled with like so much self-hatred that I didn't know how to love myself, because self-love isn't a word that's like, you know, on the Home Goods sign, like love yourself. But not a lot of people, especially for myself, I don't know what that means, because I never accepted myself for who I was. And so I think the first step is really coming to terms with like, my life is shit, I'm unhappy. And then sitting with it and letting it hurt you in a way to where you have to make a decision, you know. And I think for me, making that decision 3 years ago was harder than anything I've done since, on the internal side of working to validate myself and working on my self-worth, understanding why my self-esteem was so low, understanding why I stayed in a 7-year, you know, relationship that was death by a thousand cuts, why I was built with so much guilt and resentment, and doing all these things to please everyone else but myself. And at the end of the day, like, I think that first step really is just being okay that your life sucks and being honest with yourself, because honesty is the first thing that you can give yourself that is really meaningful in the long term.
Yeah, man. Well, so what taught you to do that? Like the therapy or what was it that helped you realize that you had to go through that stage?
I actually didn't know at the time, because at the time when you're at rock bottom, like you feel like it's over. Like I was so defeated as a person. I got the college degree. I got the long-term relationship. I moved to a different state. All of these things was just me escaping all the feelings I hated about myself. And it's really hard to, now I can look back and be like, oh shit, that was rock bottom. But while I was at rock bottom, that was just life as I know it. I couldn't get off the couch. I was like mentally, like everything that was going on in my head was like, just end your life. Like no one cares about you. You are a burden. Like, why are you even here? You know what I mean? So it's, I had to go through so much pain of like fighting against myself that I didn't even know at that time that feeling good is normal. Like right now, I'm so content in where I'm at in life that to think back of like how shitty I used to feel. And I thought that was normal because I was hungover all the time. I was partying every weekend. I was numbing myself with cocaine and mollies and bottles of alcohol. And for what? Like it didn't make me feel good, because feeling like shit was my normal. So anytime I got like a glimpse of being happy, I didn't feel like I deserved it, because I'm like, wow, that was so uncomfortable. Anytime someone had something nice to say about me, it didn't match the confirmation bias I had for myself. I'm like, oh, you don't mean that. So I didn't, you know, so that comes with trust issues and all of these things. But it's really me internally not be willing to accept anything else but the miserable, you know, reality that I paid for myself pretty much. Like 10, 15 years of alcohol, drugs, self-destruction kind of accumulated in that rock bottom. And I was just spending it away. I was just doing all these stupid stuff, you know. And it's just so painful that, I don't know, it's really hard to put your finger on to describe what that feeling is like.
Yeah. And were, as a woman, were you seeking validation from men too? Like did you like draw to that toxicity, like in relationships, or not just relationships, but initial parts of relationships when you meet with someone and if they acted a certain way, that's what you're drawn to, but it was really like a toxic trait? Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I understand completely. I think what fueled the fire of my self-validation, because I was a bartender and I did bikini bartending for a while. So all the shallow, superficial comments I got is just about my looks. There's only a few like really good handful of clientele that actually understands like the smarts and all that stuff and the wit and the humor and actually true connection. But I didn't allow myself to feel that, because anything that's vulnerable and anything that that is leading towards like a real conversation or intimacy, I would immediately shut down, you know. So I think the last relationship just reaffirmed how shitty of a person I was, because I don't think I've ever felt more worthless, except just being in that relationship that just taught me, like, I am not a good person. Then it's like, why is this person with me? As the relationship was failing, it's my responsibility. And that validation just never came to fruition in that relationship itself. Because I think that 7 year, now I call it like a karmic debt, is a reflection of exactly what a shitty person I was and who I attracted. Just everything that I enabled for myself and other people is just my alcoholism and drugs. That's all I knew how to do. And that's all I knew how to, you know, show for. So unless I'm drinking or snorting cocaine, like, I literally had nothing going on for me at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And during those years, what was the time, like, do you remember a time where you were like, holy shit, how did I get out of that one? Like, did you ever get into a situation where you're like, and you look back now and you're like, first of all, being in that situation should have been scary shit. But then secondly, like, I can't even believe I got out of it. Does anything come to mind?
I think a lot of the nights that we were doing, like, you know, the bingers, so like 9 in the morning, and part of me wanted to stop like at 4 a.m. But the part that was seeking validations of the friends that I had at the time was like, no, I had to be here because I have to prove how hardcore I am, or how down I am, or how, you know, how I can't really describe that feeling. But like intuitively, like, I'm like, I want to go home. I'm tired. Like, I'm tired of playing this character. And a lot of those nights I was so close to like pushing myself to the edge of like, I'm like, what if I just had an overdose right now and just end this all? And some of those nights, you know, when people tell stories, it's like, oh, what a fucking massive, like, wild party we had. But I was sitting there, like, contemplating, like, okay, so if I died right now, it would just be a natural overdose. And I don't even have to try to commit suicide. You know what I mean? And I think sitting in that room, and sometimes now I think about it, I'm like, what if that was to happen? And I died by accident, not living true to my potential, but just because I gave in to my weaknesses at the time of not being able to control my own thoughts and like my own actions and my own behavior. Like, I could have died so many times in my 20s from drug overdose that it's crazy now that I think about it. And like driving drunk and doing all of these things that put my life at risk and in danger, that I can't fathom like the ability of the reckless thoughts I had at the time.
Yeah. And then when you're done partying, you go and you finally do fall asleep. It's the worst. All the thoughts running through your head and thinking about, man, I'm banged up again. And I've been, man. All right. So from here, right? Like, imagine what you're living now. And you're saying like, you're content now. You have a podcast, you're investing, you're doing some other projects. You're in a relationship now. Like, you wouldn't have had any of that if you didn't keep, pursuing, you know, who you really are and keep going. I always say this in the mornings, like, even now, like, we're, you know, entrepreneurs are crazy sons of bitches, man. Like, we're crazy, right? And I'm like, every month, once a month, I have to pay this one credit card. It's like business expenses and all this. And I'm like, every time I pay it, I got to switch my perspective to, oh my gosh, like, this X amount of money's coming out now. I thought I was here. Now I got to push this out. Instead of that, I should say, damn, I'm so blessed to be in a position to be able to pay this amount of money and this and that, right? But you wouldn't have got here if you didn't keep going, right? Keep going. So like, now that you've reflected upon that, you wouldn't have had what you have now, the life you have, getting to meet C-Rock, which it's not a big deal, but it kind of is. But no, but like
too, I know it.
And you get to reflect upon that now. And from that perspective, I'm so sure of myself that saying this, that you're glad that you kept going.
Yeah, I'm really glad I kept fighting. There's a little voice inside me that, I call it the little voice. There's a lot of voices within us, right? Like, some days I have my inner bitch voice that's like super loud, like, you can't do this, you're a failure. And the other days are just all of my demons all together partying in my fucking head, man. It's fucking crazy. Like, all the self-doubt, the limitations, like, the things I hate about myself. It's all there. And sometimes it's easier to say, like, I'm going to go fight my demons. But sometimes fighting my demons is really just sitting by myself and crying and like, asking myself hard questions that I don't want to face. It's like, what is this about this situation that makes me so judgmental? Or what is this about this desire or this envious feeling that I get when I talk to this person that makes, is there something that they have or that they perceive to have that I think I want, and would that make me happier? You know, so asking yourself really, really hard questions and being honest with yourself is truly the hardest thing you'll ever have to do in your entire fucking life, you know? And that's how you keep fighting. It's not lying to yourself over and over and living in denial of like, oh, my life's all right. The all right life is is an autopilot life, you know? Most people move through life just fine. Or what I can't speak on behalf of other people. But I know that I've talked to a lot of people that hate their life, hate their job, hate their relationship, hate everything that's going on in their life. And yet they're creating an image that their life is fucking perfect. But deep down, they'll have a conversation. They're like, I'm depressed. I can't. I don't know how to get out of this relationship, because they're not willing to do the work to develop the tools. I didn't know how to get out of that relationship either. I felt like I was stuck for fucking ever. You know, and I think a part of that is something that you have to be willing to put in that kind of work to earn your rights to even be honest with yourself.
Yeah. And so as we wrap up here, like what is one thing you hate about yourself now? And what's one thing you love about yourself?
So something I really am still working on is I'm really impatient, and that's something I hate about myself, but I'm really impatient, and sometimes it pays off because that makes me want to execute. Like, it actually pushes me, right? Because I'm so like my ambition is so fucking high sometimes when my brain's activated that I'm super focused and I'm just like, I gotta get this done. But when I'm not activated, the part of my ADHD brain is just like, oh, I'm a fucking potato. I'm worthless. I can't do anything. But because my brain is not allowing me to, so I have to like accept that I live in this duality of like, I want things done, but I have to be patient. It's a marathon, not a sprint. So that's something I am still actively working on. And something I love about myself is my self-awareness, because that encompasses just loving every piece of me that I used to hate so much and now I'm super at peace with. And just understanding like, hey, you're a work in process. Like, it's okay. It's okay to feel this on a certain day, but it's not okay to act recklessly based on that behavior and then blame that, you know? So accountability and self-awareness, yeah. I think it's my best traits outside of being fucking hilarious.
I love it. I know this podcast is talking about the dark times and all that. So as we wind down here, what's going on right now? What are you working on? And where can people, you know, go deeper with you?
I'm working on closing a business. So hopefully by June 1st, we will have a different conversation when I'm off my NDA. Once I sign some contracts, we'll be back in touch. But I'm honestly just super excited for it, because I've gone on this rabbit hole chase in the entrepreneurship realm in the last 4 or 5 years, and I've failed at multiple things. I'm finally not chasing trends. I'm not doing what social media tells me. I'm finally doing something that is coming, like it's coming from my heart. It's something that I'm like, I love building, and it's, you know, I have to keep it offline for now, but it's something that I'm pouring so much time and attention and effort and intention into building a business that I'm so proud of, that no guru on the internet sold me, right? So that's something I'm really fucking proud of. So if people want to connect with me and get real on some shit, like come at me on, you know, Tonosaurus. I decided not to change it to Tony Wynn because Tonosaurus is, it's fun. It's out there. And Fit and Frugal Pod.
So that's Tawny Soros. Just so you guys know, her name, Tawny, T-A-W-N-I, or T-A-W-N-I, and then Soros, like Baranosaurus or something, but S-A-U-R-U-S. So go check her out. It'll be in the show notes. Tawny, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. And guys, go check out the podcast, Fit and Frugal. Go check out Tawny. Let her know you heard her here on the What You Made Up show. Tawny, thanks for being here.
Of course. Thank you, C-Rod.
Hang tight while I wrap this up. All right. So I want to thank you, listener, for being here or watching, however you're consuming this content. I really appreciate it, the support that you've given me. Please like, subscribe, share this out on social. Let your friends, family, coworkers know about this. Let's continue to grow this show, because we're impacting lives with every story that's told here on the What Are You Made Up show with your boy C-Rock from That One Studio. Until next time, C-Rock and Tawny signing off. Beat That One.
Music licensing reimagined.